Lincoln, Desk 31.
Even with such a strong party organization and so many influential backers, Lincoln couldn't be sure of re-election. The October elections for state officials in Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania suggested how close the race still was. Lincoln spent the evening of October 11th at the War Department, where he, Stanton, Assistant Secretary of War Dana, and Hay eagerly scrutinized the telegraphic returns as they trickled in. Between dispatches, the president read aloud several chapters from the recently published Nasby Papers by David Ross Locke. Lincoln found these comic sketches about Petroleum V. Nasby, a dissolute, semi-literate copperhead who lived at Confederate Crossroads, vastly amusing. And he once told Charles Sumner, "For the genius to write these things, I'd gladly give up my office." Usually, Stanton found Lincoln's humor irritating. But this time he was in a good mood and enjoyed Nasby's adventures almost as much as the president did. From the beginning, the news from Ohio and Indiana was good. But the Pennsylvania reports, as Hay remarked, began to be streaked with lean. Lincoln grew anxious because, he said, Pennsylvania's enormous weight and influence, which, if cast definitely into the scale, would close the campaign. The final totals were not in for several days, when it became evident that the continuing Cameron-Curtin feud had hurt the ticket and the anticipated huge Republican majority had been whittled down to about 400 home votes in the entire state. Only the soldiers' vote, overwhelmingly Republican, assured victory. 2 days after the October elections, Lincoln tried to predict the national vote in November. Jotting down an estimate of the electoral vote, he calculated that McClellan would carry New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, all of the border states, and Illinois, with a total of 114 electoral votes, while he would get 117 from all the rest of the states. Someone else added the 3 electoral votes of Nevada to his column. It was too close for comfort. But in the next few days, he became more optimistic. Republican strength in Indiana and Ohio proved greater than anticipated. Maryland adopted a constitution outlawing slavery. The soldier vote was overwhelmingly Republican, and Republicans could take heart from the vigorous campaign that Sheridan was waging to clear Early's Confederates out of the Shenandoah Valley. Lincoln revised his thinking. "It does look as if the people wanted me to stay here a little longer," he told a visitor, "and I suppose I shall have to, if they do." During the remaining weeks of the campaign, he did his best to make the outcome certain. He continued to try to consolidate his party by sending his private secretary out to Missouri with a view to mediating between the Charcoal and Claybank factions. Nicolay found that the endless party feud in that state hinged not on either principle or policy, but upon personal spite and greed for spoils. And he tried to persuade both factions that it was in their best interests to support Lincoln's re-election. Lincoln encouraged soldier voting in the field so enthusiastically that E.B. Washburn said, "If it could be done in no other way, the president would take a carpet bag and go around and collect those votes himself." He even went so far as to permit Republican agents to use a government steamer on the Mississippi River to collect the ballots of sailors on the federal gunboats. On election day, hundreds of federal employees in Washington were furloughed in order to return to their homes and vote. Even the camps and hospitals are depleted, reported the banker Henry D. Cook. The streets wear a quiet Sunday air. In the department buildings, the empty corridors respond with hollow echoes to the footfall of the solitary visitor. The hotels are almost tenantless, and the streetcars drone lazily along with half-filled seats. The election went off smoothly. From the earliest returns, it was clear that the Republicans had won a huge victory. They carried every state except New Jersey, Delaware, and Kentucky. The Democrats had waged a vigorous campaign with a united party, and Democratic candidates made a strong showing in the cities and in those counties where there were large numbers of Irish-American and German-American voters. The 45% of the popular vote that McClellan received was more than respectable, especially in view of the fact that all the southern states were still out of the Union and, of course, not voting. Republican success was due largely to the same groups of voters who'd supported the party in 1860. Native-born farmers in the countryside, better-off skilled workers and professional men in the city, and voters of New England descent everywhere. As in 1860, younger voters were especially attracted to the Republican Party, and the soldier vote went overwhelmingly for Lincoln. Election night was rainy and foggy in Washington, and the president spent the evening at the War Department waiting for the returns. The first reports were encouraging, and he sent them over to Mrs. Lincoln, saying, "She's more anxious than I." Presently, Thomas T. Eckert, head of the telegraph office, came in wet and muddy because he'd fallen while crossing the street. In a genial mood, the president was reminded of another rainy evening back in 1858, when he'd been on the square at Springfield reading the returns on his contest with Douglas for the Senate. On his way home, he nearly fell in the muddy street. But he recovered himself and thought, "It's a slip and not a fall." "For such an awkward fellow," he remarked to the group in the telegraph office, "I'm pretty sure-footed." Chapter 20. With Charity for All. Laus Deo, George Templeton Strong wrote in his diary on the day after the election, "The crisis has been passed, and the most momentous popular election ever held since ballots were invented has decided against treason and disunion. The American people can be trusted to take care of the national honor." "How glorious the result of the election," echoed one of Senator John Sherman's correspondents. "Language can't describe nor imagination conceive its importance to our country and the world. It's the great political event in all history." Lincoln himself rejoiced that the balloting demonstrated that a people's government can sustain a national election in the midst of a great civil war. Until now, it's not been known to the world that this was a possibility. But he was careful not to seek personal advantage from his victory. On election night, when Gustavus V. Fox pointed out to him that two of the most vehement radical critics of the administration had been defeated and crowed that retribution has come upon them both, Lincoln remarked, "You have more of that feeling of personal resentment than I. Perhaps I may have too little of it, but I never thought it paid." He had no intention of using his impressive mandate to settle old quarrels with his Republican critics. "I'm in favor of short statutes of limitations in politics," he said. Nor did he gloat over the defeat of the Democrats. On November 10th, when serenaders came to the north portico of the White House to celebrate his victory, he appeared in a second-floor window to make a brief response. Instead of celebrating the Republican triumph, he sought reconciliation with his political foes, asking, "Now that the election is over, may not all reunite in a common effort to save our common country? For my own part," he continued, "I've striven and shall strive to avoid placing any obstacle in the way. So long as I've been here, I've not willingly planted a thorn in any man's bosom." The president's address didn't placate his bitterest enemies. Pro-Confederate sympathizers in the North viewed Lincoln's re-election as a disaster. Most leaders of the Confederacy shared that opinion. Jefferson Davis and his associates had cherished the hope that Lincoln would be defeated. To that end, in the months before the election, Confederate emissaries in Canada had tried to influence Northern opinion through the aborted peace negotiations with Horace Greeley, and through financial subvention for the Vallandigham Peace Democrats. They'd planned an uprising at Chicago during the Democratic National Convention. They'd sent agents to incite violence in Chicago and New York on Election Day, and they'd staged raids on the Great Lakes and at St. Albans, Vermont. None of these tactics had persuaded the North to repudiate Lincoln. Sadly, Confederate newspapers lamented that henceforth Southerners had to recognize that the people who lately called us brethren were insatiable for our blood, at least so long as they were led by a vulgar buffoon who exercised more autocratic powers than king, emperor, czar, kaiser, or even despotic Caesar himself. Facing certain defeat, unless some drastic measures could be taken, Confederates, in the final months of 1864, began to explore their options. Some looked to further peace negotiations with the North. Others sought foreign intervention, and President Davis sent the wealthy Louisiana planter Duncan Kenner abroad to offer emancipation of the slaves in return for British and French recognition. Many Southerners were willing to take the desperate risk of enrolling blacks in the Confederate armies, and inevitably a few began to think that the only way to avert Confederate defeat was by removing the head of the Union government. The idea of eliminating Abraham Lincoln was not a new one in 1864. Even before his first election in 1860, he began to receive threats against his life. Initially, these threats caused him some concern, and they made Mary frantic with worry. As president-elect, he'd felt obliged to make a secret night trip through Baltimore to avoid attack by secessionists. But once he was settled in the White House, he ceased to pay much attention to the danger and directed his secretaries to throw away most threatening letters without showing them to him. By 1864, Lincoln told Francis B. Carpenter such letters no longer caused him apprehension. When the artist expressed surprise, he replied, "Oh, there's nothing like getting used to things." Lincoln believed that in a democratic society, the chief executive must not be screened from the public. "It'd never do," he told a member of Halleck's staff, "for a president to have guards with drawn sabers at his door, as if he fancied he were, or were trying to be, or were assuming to be, an emperor." In addition, he recognized that it was impossible for him to be fully protected. "If a group of conspirators plotted his death," he said, No vigilance could keep them out. A conspiracy to assassinate, if such there were, could easily obtain a pass to see me for any one or more of its instruments. Consequently, like many other American presidents, Lincoln took few precautions to protect his security. During the first years of his presidency, he often took long walks through the streets of Washington late at night or in the early morning hours, either alone or with a single companion. Nearly every night before going to bed, Lincoln strolled through the densely shaded White House grounds to the War Department, often with no escort or guard. During the hot months, when the Lincolns stayed at the Soldiers' Home, he often rode back and forth to the White House on horseback or in an unguarded carriage. He frequently attended the theater in Washington, accompanied only by Mary, or sometimes Tad, and one or two civilian friends. His indifference to security on these occasions drove his old friend Ward Lehman, the marshal of the District of Columbia, who felt responsible for his safety, nearly to distraction. Once Lehman angrily offered to resign when he heard that the president had gone to the theater, attended only by Charles Sumner and the Baron Geralt, the elderly Prussian minister, neither of whom, Lehman sneered, could defend himself against an assault from any able-bodied woman in this city. At the outbreak of the war, there was no military guard at the White House, and the two civilian attendants, one for the outer door, the other for the president's office on the second floor, were often absent from their posts. In 1862, General James S. Wadsworth, the military commander of the District of Columbia, improved security by detailing a body of cavalry to escort the president on his rides to and from the soldiers' home. But Lincoln objected that the soldiers made such a clatter with their sabers and spurs that he and Mary couldn't hear themselves talk. The next summer, these soldiers were replaced by the Union Light Guard, a company of 100 carefully selected Ohioans mounted on handsome black steeds. Two of these guards were stationed at all times at each of the gateways to the executive mansion, and a non-commissioned officer was posted in the front portico. An infantry company of Pennsylvania Bucktails guarded the southern approaches to the White House. At Lehman's urging, the chief of the Washington Metropolitan Police detailed four officers for special duty at the executive mansion. Wearing civilian clothing and carrying concealed weapons, these men were supposed to accompany the president on his walks and to escort him to the theater. At night, one of them remained on duty upstairs in the White House outside the Lincoln's private rooms. These increased precautions reflected Stanton's growing anxiety that the president's life was in danger. In 1864, Lincoln began to receive an unusual number of letters about plots to kidnap or assassinate him. Most were anonymous and undocumented. For instance, in July, Lizzie W.S. alerted the president that there were hordes of secesh sympathizers around Washington who wouldn't hesitate to shoot him on his rides to the soldiers' home. "If you value your life, do, I entreat you, discontinue your visits out of the city," she begged. A laborer in West Virginia reported overhearing a conversation in which one man assured another that the plan was all made that if old Abe was reelected, "We are a-gonna kill him, and I am the man that is a-gonna do it with your help." Hostility toward the president sharply increased during the last months of 1864 because both disaffected Northerners and embittered Confederates began to realize that what they considered the abuses and excesses of the Lincoln administration were going to be continued for another 4 years. Evils that, up to this point, had seemed transient now felt intolerable. Since the ballot didn't remove the despot, it was time to find other means. In August, direly anticipating Lincoln's success, the La Crosse, Wisconsin Democrat, edited by the notorious copperhead Marcus M. Brick Pomeroy, observed, "And if he's elected for another 4 years, we trust some bold hand will pierce his heart with dagger point for the public good." In the Confederacy, more thought was given to kidnapping Lincoln than to assassinating him. Abducting the President of the United States would present the South with several advantages. If Lincoln could be safely seized and spirited away to Richmond, perhaps he'd finally agree to negotiate with the Confederate government. The person of the President might make a powerful argument for suspending Grant's merciless attacks. And, the most appealing argument of all, Lincoln could be used as a hostage to secure the release of some 200,000 captured Confederate soldiers languishing in northern prisons. In the early years of the war, Confederate authorities firmly discouraged all such schemes, and Secretary of War James A. Seddon announced, "The laws of war and morality, as well as Christian principles and sound policy, forbid the use of such means." But after the Kilpatrick-Dahlgren raid in February and March of 1864, when the Confederates captured documents purporting to show that the invaders planned to burn Richmond and kill Jefferson Davis, more Southerners were willing to contemplate some form of retaliation against Lincoln. In late September 1864, Thomas Nelson Conrad, a Confederate preacher and spy, led a team of three associates through the lines into Washington, where they hoped to seize the President as his carriage turned into the grounds of the Soldiers' Home. To their surprise, they found Lincoln surrounded by a heavy guard. Possibly the War Department had been alerted by an anonymous letter the President received a few days earlier, warning him to keep watch and ward with arms ready and at hand against a likely attack on September 26th. More likely, Stanton ordered additional protection because of what seemed to be an attempt on Lincoln's life. While the President was returning to the Soldiers' Home one evening in August, someone fired a shot at him. Lincoln was unscathed because his frightened horse raced for safety. But the next day, the soldiers in his guard found his $8 plug hat with a bullet hole through the crown. Unable to get near the President, Conrad remained in Washington until at least November 10th, hoping for another opportunity. But he was obliged to report that his mission had been a humiliating failure. Lincoln never knew of Conrad's plan to kidnap him, but frequent threats and warnings reminded him of his vulnerability. Showing John W. Forney a pigeonhole in his office desk, where he'd filed more than 80 letters of this sort, he told the newspaperman, "I know I'm in danger, but I'm not going to worry over threats like these." In the weeks after his re-election, Lincoln felt he had more important matters to worry about. As he was about to begin a second term, party workers demanded rewards for their service in the campaign, and they harassed the President with applications for jobs. Once again, his office was filled with office seekers. "And sometimes," he said, It seemed that every visitor darted at him and with thumb and finger carried off a portion of his vitality. Overwhelmed, he asked Senator Daniel B. Clark of New Hampshire, "Can't you and others start a public sentiment in favor of making no changes in offices except for good and sufficient cause? It seems as though the bare thought of going through again what I did the first year here would crush me." In the end, he concluded that he would change as few office holders as possible, because, he observed, "to remove a man's very easy, but when I go to fill his place, there are 20 applicants, and of these I must make 19 enemies." But some changes were necessary in his own official family. Both Nicolay and Hay were exhausted after nearly 4 years of arduous service as his private secretaries, and Nicolay was in poor health. Lincoln decided to give Nicolay the lucrative appointment as United States Consul at Paris, and to make Hay the Secretary of Legation in France. He planned to offer the post of private secretary to Noah Brooks, the affable and politically astute correspondent of the Sacramento Union. Friends told him that Brooks was capable of rendering him infinitely more substantial service than Nicolay. In the months between his election in November and his inauguration in March, the president had also to select 4 new members for his cabinet. He'd already appointed William Dennison, who'd presided over the National Union Convention at Baltimore, acting Postmaster General, and he now made that appointment permanent. Shortly after the election, Edward Bates, now 71 years old, offered his resignation as Attorney General. To replace him, Lincoln first turned to the highly efficient Joseph Holt, but the Judge Advocate General declined. At Holt's suggestion, the president then gave the post to another loyal Kentuckian, James Speed, brother of Joshua F. Speed. Lincoln had never found John P. Usher a very satisfactory colleague, and when the Secretary of the Interior resigned on March 8th, he welcomed an opportunity to replace him with Senator James Harlan of Iowa. Harlan had been one of the administration's strongest defenders in Congress, and the engagement of his daughter, Mary, to Robert Todd Lincoln strengthened his personal attachment to the president. In February, just before the beginning of the new term, Fessenden had also asked to be relieved of his duties as Secretary of the Treasury so that he could return to the Senate. Lincoln wanted to replace him with Senator E.D. Morgan, the former governor of New York, who'd been chairman of the Republican National Committee and had arranged for the Baltimore Convention. When Morgan declined, the president selected the colorless but efficient controller of currency, Hugh McCulloch. Made over a period of months, these appointments, taken together, offered insight into the likely character of the second Lincoln administration. In contrast to the members of the original cabinet, none of these appointees was a major party leader, and none had aspirations for the presidency. Lincoln now felt so strong that he didn't have to surround himself with the heads of the warring Republican factions. He didn't require ideological conformity of the men he chose. Dennison, Holt, and Speed became more or less affiliated with the radical wing of the Republican Party, but Morgan and McCulloch were strong conservatives. The president didn't want his cabinet members to be rubber stamps, and he was supremely confident of his ability to handle disagreement among his advisers. Unlike his original cabinet, his new appointees, like the holdovers, Seward, Stanton, and Welles, were warmly attached to Lincoln personally. He could now afford the luxury of a loyal cabinet. No appointment at the president's disposal had potentially greater significance than that of Chief Justice of the United States to succeed Roger B. Taney. Lincoln was fully aware of the importance of his choice. Along with the associate justices he'd already appointed, Noah Swain, Samuel F. Miller, David Davis, and Stephen J. Field, the next Chief Justice would form a majority on the court that would decide vital cases arising out of the Civil War. A lawyer himself, the president wanted to name a man deeply versed in the law, rather than an ideologue or a theorist. He hoped the new Chief Justice would recognize that the function of courts is to decide cases, not principles. Lincoln had deliberately postponed announcing a choice until after the election. In the interval, he went over in his mind the list of strongly recommended candidates and rejected one after another for what appeared good reasons. Bates was too old. Stanton couldn't be spared from the War Department. Everts wasn't widely known. Blair could never be confirmed by the Senate. In the end, as at the beginning, he was left with the name of Salmon P. Chase. The strongest argument against Chase was his unquenchable political ambition. If he keeps on with the notion that he's destined to be president of the United States, and which in my judgment he'll never be, Lincoln remarked to a senator, he'll never acquire that fame and influence as a Chief Justice which he would otherwise certainly attain. But the arguments for Chase were much stronger. During the next few years, the most difficult cases likely to come before the court were those involving the constitutionality of Lincoln's emancipation policies and the validity of the greenbacks with which the war was being financed. In selecting a judge, Lincoln explained to Representative George S. Boutwell of Massachusetts, "We cannot ask a man what he'll do, and if we should, and he should answer us, we should despise him for it. Therefore, we must take a man whose opinions are known." Chase's record, the president thought, put him unquestionably on the right side of these basic issues. The president chose Chase to be Chief Justice because he thought him worthy. But he expected to receive political advantages from his choice. The appointment was part of his broader program of conciliating all the factions within the Republican Party. He tried to make the selection of a radical as painless as possible to conservative Republicans. When Francis P. Blair, Sr. renewed his plea for the appointment of his son, the president agreed that Montgomery's qualifications were indeed estimable, but said he had to consult his advisers before making a choice. "Although I may be stronger as an authority," he told the elder Blair, "yet if all the rest oppose, I must give way. If the strongest horse in the team would go ahead, he cannot if all the rest hold him back." Any insider would have recognized that Lincoln's statement was absurd. He didn't consult the cabinet about the appointment and didn't even tell them his choice until after he sent Chase's name to the Senate. But to the elder Blair, his explanation made perfectly good sense. The president had learned how to make his hard decisions appear to be the work of a committee. At the same time, he sought to secure the greatest possible advantage with the radicals from the appointment. With Chase's partisans, he gained credit for magnanimity in selecting a man who'd been his sharp critic and a formidable political rival. Radicals credited rumors that the president had to force himself to make this choice, that, according to one report, rather than nominate Chase, he would have swallowed the Elkhorn chair that the frontiersman Seth Kinman had given him. Another had him say he'd sooner have eat flat irons than do it. A few days after he sent Chase's name to the Senate, Lincoln candidly explained his purpose to Ward Lehman. His appointment will satisfy the radicals, and after that, they'll not dare kick up against any appointment I may make. With unwanted optimism, he added that it was hard to see how in the future they could interpose a reasonable objection to his policies. His calculations proved exactly right. For the new session of Congress, which assembled on December 5th, proved remarkably supportive of his policies. Congressmen judged that it wasn't politically expedient to attack the policies of a president who'd just been triumphantly reelected. Military victories further strengthened Lincoln's hand. The capture of Atlanta had probably determined the outcome of the 1864 election. And now, while Grant grimly pinned down Lee's army before Richmond, Sherman continued his march to the sea, cutting a swath of devastation through Georgia. Like Grant, Lincoln initially was anxious, if not fearful, of Sherman's plan. And the draft of his annual message to Congress included a promise that our cause could, if need be, survive the loss of the whole detached force. He deleted the phrase, doubtless because it sounded too pessimistic. But his doubts didn't disappear until he received a telegram from Sherman on December 25th. I beg to present you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah, with 150 heavy guns and plenty of ammunition, and also about 25,000 bales of cotton. During the same time, General Thomas's forces checked the Confederate invasion of Tennessee at Franklin, November 30th, and on December 15th and 16th, routed Hood's army in the decisive Battle of Nashville. The double victory of Thomas and Sherman, Lincoln rejoiced, brings those who sat in darkness to see a great light. The president probably didn't intend to refer to members of Congress, but certainly their views underwent a remarkable transformation. Many who'd hitherto strongly opposed Lincoln now muted their criticisms. When Henry Winter Davis, always implacable in his hatred of Lincoln and his administration, proposed to condemn the president for failing to adopt a more belligerent policy toward the French in Mexico, the president found an unlikely defender in Thaddeus Stevens, hitherto one of Lincoln's most vocal critics. Other radicals chimed in to praise an executive who is doing his utmost in a patriotic spirit to preserve unimpaired all the institutions of our country, and to condemn those who, like Davis, wish to impugn his integrity in any respect whatsoever. It did seem, as the National Intelligencer observed, that the country was entering on a new era of good feeling. In the spirit of conciliation, Lincoln reached out for the support of Democrats as well as Republicans. His annual message contained an earnest plea to his political opponents to support the proposed constitutional amendment abolishing slavery throughout the United States. In the previous session of Congress, the measure had failed to secure the required two-thirds vote in the House of Representatives because all but four of the Democratic members voted against it. At Lincoln's urging, the National Union Convention had made the amendment a central plank in the platform on which he and a heavy Republican majority in the next Congress were elected. He now asked the lame duck session of the 38th Congress to reconsider the amendment. Without questioning the wisdom or patriotism of those who stood in opposition, the president urged the Democrats to rethink their position. "Of course," he admitted, "the abstract question isn't changed. But an intervening election shows almost certainly that the next Congress will pass the measure if this does not." Since adoption was simply a matter of time, he asked, "May we not agree that the sooner the better?" Arguing that some deference shall be paid to the will of the majority, simply because it is the will of the majority, he appealed for support of the amendment now. Not content with rhetorical exhortation, Lincoln used his personal authority and considerable charm to influence Democratic and border state congressmen whose votes were in doubt. Not since 1862, when he tried hard to persuade border state congressmen to support his gradual emancipation plan, had the president been so deeply involved in the legislative process. He worked closely with James M. Ashley of Ohio, the principal sponsor of the amendment in the House, to identify members who might be persuaded to support the amendment, and invited them to the executive mansion. For instance, he had a long talk with Representative James S. Rollins of Missouri, who'd voted against the amendment in June and entreated him as an old Whig and follower of that great statesman Henry Clay to join him now in supporting the measure. When Rollins said that he was ready to vote for the amendment, Lincoln pressed him to use his influence with other congressmen from his state. "The passage of this amendment will clinch the whole subject," the president assured him. "It'll bring the war, I have no doubt, rapidly to a close." If Lincoln used other means of persuading congressmen to vote for the 13th Amendment, his actions weren't recorded. Conclusions about the president's role rested on gossip and later recollections, like those of Thaddeus Stevens, who remarked, "The greatest measure of the 19th century was passed by corruption, aided and abetted by the purest man in America." Lincoln was told that he might win some support from New Jersey Democrats if he could persuade Charles Sumner to drop a bill to regulate the Camden and Amboy Railroad. But he declined to intervene, not on grounds of principle, but because, he said, "I can do nothing with Mr. Sumner in these matters." One New Jersey Democrat, well known as a lobbyist for the Camden and Amboy, who'd voted against the amendment in July, did abstain in the final vote. But it can't be proved that Lincoln influenced his change. Whatever the president's role, in the final balloting, more than two-thirds of the House members voted for the 13th Amendment and submitted it to the states for ratification. Celebrating, the House adjourned after inadvertently sending the resolution to the president, who happily signed it on February 1st. He was untroubled when senators pointed out that, according to a Supreme Court decision of 1798, presidential approval was not required for constitutional amendments. He was convinced that, with or without his signature, the 13th Amendment would root out the original disturbing cause of the rebellion and would fully settle all questions about the legal validity of the Emancipation Proclamation. Finally, the country had a king's cure for all the evils. One important bit of assistance Lincoln gave to the adoption of the 13th Amendment, he was not prepared to make public at the time. During the last days of debate in the House of Representatives, rumors spread that Confederate commissioners were on their way to Washington to negotiate a settlement, that peace was at hand. Fearing defections among the reluctant supporters of the measure, Ashley anxiously asked the president whether there was any truth in the reports. Choosing his words with care, Lincoln replied, "So far as I know, there are no peace commissioners in the city or likely to be in it." His note calmed the Democrats, who, as he said later, would have gone off in a tangent at the last moment had they smelt peace. In fact, at that very moment, a Confederate peace commission, consisting of Alexander H. Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, John A. Campbell, the Confederate Assistant Secretary of War, and Robert M. T. Hunter, the prominent Virginia Confederate senator, was crossing into Union lines, but at City Point, not Washington. Behind their visit lay some careful planning on Lincoln's part. Earlier, he'd strongly opposed any negotiation with the Confederates, refusing to meet with Stevens in 1863, and as recently as July, insisting on terms he knew the Confederate emissaries at Niagara Falls could not accept. Talk of peace, he then thought, would lower army morale. Worse, it might lead to an armistice that, in effect, gave the Confederacy its independence. But now things had changed. The overwhelming victories of Sherman and Thomas in the West, coupled with the unremitting devastation that Grant and Sheridan were wreaking in Virginia, had weakened the Southern will to fight, and there were strong indications that the Confederacy might be coming to pieces. Grant believed that half of Lee's army would desert if there was an armistice. The governors of Georgia and North Carolina were openly talking of making a separate peace. The Committee on Foreign Affairs of the Confederate House of Representatives debated a resolution creating a peace commission. Representative Henry S. Foote demanded a cessation of hostilities and restoration of peace and declared that only Jefferson Davis stood in the way of ending the war. Lincoln's annual message to Congress in December 1864 sought to take advantage of this disarray among the Confederates. After what he'd learned through the Jacques Gilmore mission, he was confident that no attempt at negotiation with the insurgent leader, whenever possible he avoided Jefferson Davis's name and never referred to him as President of the Confederate States, could result in any good. He'd accept nothing short of severance of the Union, precisely what we will not and cannot give. But the president continued, "What's true of him who heads the insurgent cause is not necessarily true of those who follow. Although he cannot re-accept the Union, they can." To encourage these second-level Confederate leaders, the president promised generous terms. They can at any moment have peace simply by laying down their arms and submitting to the national authority under the Constitution. But the generous program of amnesty and pardon, which he'd offered in December 1863, and which was still open to all, would not remain so indefinitely. "The time may come, probably will come," he said, "when more rigorous measures shall be adopted." Several intermediaries attempted to follow the lead the president offered. James R. Gilmore wanted to try another peace mission, this time to North Carolina, where he was sure he could persuade Governor Zebulon B. Vance to bring the state back into the Union, but Lincoln didn't think this approach expedient. The plan of a former Illinois legislator evoked a more favorable response from the White House. Backed by Browning, James W. Singleton, a leading peace Democrat, secured Lincoln's permission to go to Richmond in order to sound Confederate opinion on ending the war. Singleton spent 2 pleasant weeks in the Confederate capital and had interviews with Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and others. He returned to tell the president that Southerners were eager for peace on generous terms, but that they were unwilling to give up slavery except for a fair compensation coupled with other liberal terms of Reconstruction secured by constitutional amendments. Lincoln listened, but his faith in Singleton, always slight, dwindled when it became clear that he was less interested in peace than in buying up huge quantities of Southern cotton and tobacco. The most conspicuous effort at peacemaking was that of Francis P. Blair, Sr., who reached Richmond on January 11th. He'd wanted to go earlier, but Lincoln had refused permission, saying, "Come to me when Savannah falls." When the president did allow the elder statesman to cross the lines, he declined to talk with him about his project or to offer any instructions. Blair was on his own. In a long interview with Jefferson Davis, who had been a close friend of his family before the war, Blair argued that slavery was no longer an insurmountable obstruction to pacification, since the recent decision to enroll blacks in the Confederate Army necessarily entailed giving them freedom. The reunion of the North and South was now inevitable. Only the machinations of European monarchs could prevent it, and the activities of France's puppet ruler of Mexico, Maximilian, showed how real was this danger. Davis could remove this threat by agreeing to an armistice with the Union and removing his armies to Texas, where, as dictator if necessary, he could lead the fight to drive out the French invaders. Doubtless, many Northern soldiers would volunteer to join his forces, and Blair offered the services of his son, General Frank Blair. According to the elder Blair, Davis rose to the bait. He doubted, or perhaps it was Blair who doubted, the good faith of Seward in any negotiations, but he was willing to accept Blair's assurance that if Lincoln plights his faith to any man, he'll maintain his word inviolably. He gave Blair a letter to take to Washington, promising to appoint a commission that would enter into negotiations with a view to secure peace to the two countries. This was not at all what Lincoln had in mind. He wanted to undermine the authority of the Confederate government and to fragment the Confederate state, not to negotiate with its leader as an equal. Promptly, he sent Blair back to Richmond with the message that he would be willing to receive a Confederate commission that looked toward securing peace to the people of our one common country. That should have been that. But on both sides of the battle lines, sentiment for peace was now too strong to be derailed. Under pressure, Davis named 3 leading advocates of negotiation, Stevens, Campbell, and Hunter, as commissioners authorized not merely to secure peace between the two countries, but to discuss the issues involved in the existing war. Lincoln and Stanton were ready to refuse to receive the commissioners because they wouldn't concede, even for purposes of discussion, that the Confederacy was a separate nation. At this point, Grant, who was increasingly eager to finish off the war, and who was not attuned to the niceties of diplomatic negotiations, intervened. He persuaded the commissioners to delete from their instructions the reference to two separate countries, and wired to Washington that he hoped Lincoln could meet with them. Agreeing with Grant that to send the three Confederates back to Richmond without any expression from anyone in authority would be impolitic, Lincoln forthwith joined Seward at Fort Monroe for a conference, from which he expected little. On the morning of February 3rd, Stevens, Hunter, and Campbell came aboard the President's steamer, the River Queen, at Hampton Roads, for an interview of several hours. Lincoln hadn't seen Stevens for 16 years, when they were both Whig members of the House of Representatives, and he greeted the Confederate Vice President with a smile and a handshake. Watching the 90-pound Stevens take off his thick gray woolen overcoat, his long wool muffler, and several shawls, he laughed, "Never have I seen so small a nubbin come out of so much husk." The five men agreed that the discussion was to be informal, that no papers or documents would be read, and that no notes would be taken. Stevens opened by asking, "Well, Mr. President, is there no way of putting an end to the present trouble and bringing about a restoration of the general good feeling and harmony between the different states and sections of the country?" Thus, at the outset, he avoided making an issue of whether there was now one country or two. Lincoln replied that there was but one way that he knew of, and that was for those who were resisting the laws of the Union to cease that resistance. The Confederates then began to explore the path that Blair had apparently opened. Stevens asked whether, in order to give time for passions to cool, there was no continental question that could temporarily engage the attention of both sides to the present conflict. In short, just as Blair had suggested, could there not be an armistice during which Southern and Northern armies could join in driving the French out of Mexico? Lincoln replied bluntly that he hadn't authorized Blair's mission, and that he couldn't consider any proposition of an armistice that wasn't based upon a pledge first given for the ultimate restoration of the Union. Since Stevens was obviously unwilling to give up the possibility of a Mexican adventure, Seward suggested that he develop what he called a philosophical basis for that scheme, and the Confederate Vice President did so at considerable length, discoursing on the importance of maintaining the Monroe Doctrine. Seward raised objections to his arguments, and Hunter made it clear that he differed with Stevens and thought the Southern people would be found unwilling to kindle a new war with the French on any such pretense. All three men realized that the discussion was pointless, since, as Stevens said, Lincoln had virtually closed all further conference on that subject. Campbell then asked what terms of reconstruction would be offered if the Confederate states agreed to return to the Union. Lincoln replied that once resistance to the national authority ceased, the states would be immediately restored to their practical relations to the Union, a phrase that he used repeatedly. But he made it clear that he would not enter into negotiations while Southerners were in arms against the United States. When Hunter attempted to show that governments had often entered into agreements with rebels, and pointed out that Charles I of England had frequently negotiated with those who were fighting against him, the President responded tartly, I don't profess to be posted in history. On all such matters I'll turn you over to Seward. All I distinctly recollect about the case of Charles I is that he lost his head in the end. As to slavery, Seward reminded the Confederates of Lincoln's pledge, made most recently in his annual message to Congress, I shall not attempt to retract or modify the Emancipation Proclamation, nor shall I return to slavery any person who is free by the terms of that proclamation or by any of the acts of Congress. The secretary then dropped a bombshell by telling the commissioners that Congress had just submitted the 13th Amendment to the states for ratification. Seeing that the Confederates were rattled by the news, Lincoln turned to Stevens. I'll tell you what I'd do if I were in your place. I'd go home and get the governor of the state of Georgia to call the legislature together and get them to recall all the state troops from the war, elect senators and members to Congress, and ratify this constitutional amendment prospectively so as to take effect, say, in 5 years. Such a ratification would be valid, in my opinion. Hunter gagged at Lincoln's terms, which he saw as nothing but an unconditional surrender on the part of the Confederate states and their people. Shortly afterward, Stevens concluded that it was entirely fruitless to have further discussion of a peace settlement, and he turned to the vexed problem of the exchange of prisoners, which Lincoln said he'd placed entirely in Grant's hands. On leaving the River Queen, the Confederate vice president urged the president to think again about his plan for an armistice and a Mexican adventure. And Lincoln replied, Well, Stevens, I will reconsider it, but I don't think my mind'll change, but I will reconsider. The Hampton Roads Conference, as Lincoln reported to Congress, ended without result. It was a failure, as he'd expected it to be, because he wouldn't negotiate with Jefferson Davis. But in the course of the conversations, Lincoln made two remarkable suggestions that showed the direction of his thinking about ending the war. Discussing possible terms of Reconstruction, Stevens asked what would be the status of the Southern slaves who had not been freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. He and Seward agreed that only about 200,000 slaves had, up to that point, gained their freedom. According to Campbell, Lincoln said that there were different opinions about the effects of his proclamation. Some believed that it was not operative at all, others that it operated only within the circle which had been occupied by the army, and others believed that it was operative everywhere in the states to which it applied. This was a question that only the courts could decide. But if Stevens's later report can be credited, the president added, his own opinion was that as the proclamation was a war measure, and would have effect only from its being an exercise of the war power, as soon as the war ceased, it would be inoperative for the future. It would be held to apply only to such slaves as had come under its operation while it was in active exercise. Stevens' record would be highly suspect were it not confirmed by other more contemporary evidence that Lincoln didn't now insist upon the end of slavery as a precondition for peace. He told Representative Singleton that his "To Whom It May Concern" letter to the Confederate commissioners at Niagara Falls had put him in a false position, that he didn't mean to make the abolition of slavery a condition of peace, and that he'd be willing to grant peace with an amnesty and restoration of the Union, leaving slavery to abide the decisions of judicial tribunals. On the day before Christmas, Lincoln repeated these views to Browning, who was advising Singleton. He declared, "Never entertained the purpose of making the abolition of slavery a condition precedent to the termination of the war and the restoration of the Union." If these conversations can be believed, the President of the United States, who had demanded emancipation as a precondition for negotiations in July 1864, who had insisted that his party's platform include a call for abolition, who'd pledged that he would never retract a word of his proclamations or send a man back into slavery, who'd just been working closely with Congress to secure the adoption of the 13th Amendment, had now changed his mind about eradicating slavery. Since Lincoln himself left no record of any of these interviews, it's possible that all the witnesses distorted his message. But it's more likely, though this can only be a speculation, that Lincoln's remarks stemmed from his realization that slavery was already dead. His principal concern now was that the war might drag on for at least another year. His purpose was to undermine the Jefferson Davis administration by appealing to those followers mentioned in his annual message to Congress. He wanted to raise their hopes, if necessary, through a campaign of misinformation. Clearly, the three Confederate commissioners at Hampton Roads would have an easier task in persuading other Southerners to lay down their arms if they promised that at least the remnants of their peculiar institution could still be saved. A second suggestion that Lincoln made to the Confederate commissioners at Hampton Roads reinforces this view of his intent. Pledging that he'd be generous in restoring Southern property seized under the Confiscation Acts, he went on to say, according to Stevens and Hunter, that he'd be willing to be taxed to remunerate the Southern people for their slaves. He had all along favored compensated emancipation, and he believed that many Northerners were in favor of an appropriation as high as $400 million for this purpose. Seward strongly dissented, showing his impatience by getting up and pacing the floor, exclaiming that in his opinion the United States had done enough in expending so much money on the war for the abolition of slavery. But Lincoln said that both sections were responsible. If it was wrong in the South to hold slaves, it was wrong in the North to carry on the slave trade and sell them to the South. He could give no assurance, enter into no stipulation on this subject, but he told the Confederates that he could mention persons whose names would astonish you who are willing to do this, if the war shall now cease without further expense and with the abolition of slavery as stated. That this proposal was not a figment of the Confederates' imagination is attested by the proposal that Lincoln drew up when he returned to Washington, which asked Congress to appropriate $400 million to be distributed to the Southern states in proportion to their slave population. Half would be paid by April 1st, if all resistance to the national authority ceased, and the remaining half by July 1st, provided that the 13th Amendment was ratified. This astonishing document told much of Lincoln's generosity of spirit and of his understanding of the problems the South faced in making the transition from a slave society to a free society. But it revealed even more his almost desperate sense of urgency to bring the war to a speedy end. The President laid his plan before the Cabinet at an evening session on February 5th, earnestly defending it as a measure of strict and simple economy. How long has this war lasted? And how long do you suppose it'll still last? He asked his advisors. Answering his own question, he told them, We cannot hope that it'll end in less than 100 days. We're now spending $3 million a day, and that'll equal the full amount I propose to pay, to say nothing of the lives lost and property destroyed. But his colleagues weren't convinced. Wells thought the president's wish to conciliate the South was commendable, but there may be such a thing as so overdoing as to cause a distrust or adverse feeling. The rebels, he predicted, would misconstrue it if the offer was made. Doubtless taking it as evidence of Northern weakness or war weariness. Anyway, as Fessenden noted, it was not advisable to submit the proposal to Congress now, because there would probably be no chance of its being adopted before the adjournment. The cabinet members felt strongly that the only way to effectually end the war was by force of arms, and that until the war was thus ended, no proposition to pay money would come from us. You're all against me, Lincoln said sadly, and he reluctantly gave up his proposal, noting, as he folded the papers away, that they were drawn up and submitted to the cabinet and unanimously disapproved by them. All along, Lincoln believed that the surest way to undermine the Confederacy was by setting up loyal governments in the southern states as they fell under the control of the Union armies. His terms for Reconstruction were both generous and vague, for he was thinking less of the status of the South after the war than of means to stop the fighting. For this reason, he wasn't greatly troubled when his military commanders failed to follow the letter of the law in setting up new Unionist regimes in the southern states. Nor was he interested in the details of registration and voting requirements. What he wanted was a series of seemingly viable, loyal governments in several southern states that could present a believable alternative to the Confederacy. That focus had led to fierce disputes with radicals in his own party, who were worried about what would happen in the South after the war, about the continuing economic and political power of the Southern planter class, the protection of the civil rights of the freedmen, and the status of black labor in the post-war South. The president wasn't indifferent to any of these concerns, but he preferred to postpone discussion of such divisive issues until the defeat of the Confederacy. In July, these differences between President and Congress had come to a head, when the legislators refused to recognize the Reconstruction governments he'd set up in Louisiana and Arkansas, and instead insisted on their own program in the Wade-Davis bill, which the president vetoed. Now, during the winter of 1864-65, the president and the Congress faced precisely the same issues, but the outcome was remarkably different. As the Congress assembled, Lincoln let it be known that he would veto any Reconstruction bill that did not recognize the free state government he'd been carefully nurturing in Louisiana. Instead of leading to a crisis, his insistence produced a compromise. On December 15th, Representative Ashley, who was also in charge of the 13th Amendment, introduced a bill designed to please both conservatives and radicals, one that he hoped the Congress would approve and the president sign. It extended congressional recognition to Lincoln's 10% government in Louisiana, but required the other southern states to follow the procedures announced in the ill-fated Wade-Davis bill, namely that voters must take the ironclad oath that they'd never supported the rebellion and that more than 50% of the eligible voters must favor any new, reconstructed government. In addition, Ashley's bill called for Negro suffrage, a provision that radicals increasingly insisted was the only way to ensure the loyalty of the Southern states. Over the next weeks, Ashley's compromise measure underwent intense scrutiny from all parties. For the more extreme radicals, Charles Sumner accepted the proposal, grumbling about the readmission of Louisiana, which ought not to be done, but rejoicing that giving suffrage to blacks in the other southern states was an immense political act. Montgomery Blair and N.P. Banks, both conservatives, went over the measure with the president, who thought the provision for black jurors and voters might be objectionable to some, agreeing that this clause would simply throw the government into the hands of the blacks, as the white people under that arrangement would refuse to vote. Banks promised that the objectionable juror clause would be removed. Congressmen of various persuasions weighed in with suggestions for change, which ranged from simply admitting Louisiana and Arkansas to insisting that all new Southern state constitutions must guarantee equality of civil rights before the law to all persons. Obligingly, Ashley amended his bill again and again in the hope of attracting a majority. He even added one remarkable provision that would recognize the existing Confederate governments in the Southern states as legitimate if they submitted to the United States, repudiated the Confederate debt, and ratified the 13th Amendment. But no combination worked, and on February 21st, Ashley was obliged to give up, conceding that no bill providing for the reorganization of loyal state government in the rebel states can pass this Congress. The defeat of Ashley's bill was a major victory for Lincoln. 7 months earlier, every Republican in the Senate and all but six Republicans in the House had voted for the Wade-Davis bill to take the process of Reconstruction out of the president's hands. Only Lincoln's pocket veto had kept the Reconstruction process under the control of the executive branch. Now, in a remarkable turnabout, the Congress failed to adopt any Reconstruction legislation. The approaching end of the congressional session left the Reconstruction entirely in Lincoln's hands. Lamenting the change, Henry Winter Davis, the arch radical who was now a lame duck congressman, mourned, "Sir, when I came into Congress 10 years ago, this was a government of law. I've lived to see it a government of personal will. Congress has dwindled from a power to dictate law and the policy of the government to a commission to audit accounts and appropriate monies to enable the executive to execute his will and not ours."
This ends Disc 31.